Previously on The Accidental Terrorist.
The year is 1986. Our hero, Elder Bill Shun, an outwardly devout 19-year-old from Utah, has been called to serve 2 years as a missionary in the wild and foreign land of Alberta, Canada. Having been out in the field for less than 3 months, he is blissfully unaware of the arrest for terrorist-related activities that looms on his ever-nearer horizon. His senior companion, Elder Deadman, a lackadaisical missionary with the work ethic of a stoned ground sloth, has been leading them through a steady course of bowling, video games, and eight ball, and the increasingly depressed Bill, pining away for his older fiancée, Katrina, has made a grim confession to President Tuttle in an attempt to get sent home early from his mission, which of course it didn't accomplish. But as Christmas dawns, the right suggestion in the wrong ear may just get that ball rolling in a completely unexpected direction. The Accidental Terrorist, a memoir by William Shun. Chapter 16, Playing Telephone. Thursday was Christmas. I woke up around 7 and I could hear Deadman puttering in the kitchen, but I didn't get out of bed. I lay there with my eyes closed for a long time, too weary to rise, trying to will myself back to sleep, back into the dream state from which I had emerged. I was thinking about Daisy, the hooker from my cousin's wedding, as I had more and more that week, and wondering if I wouldn't be better off had I found a way to take her up on her generous offer. When that made me feel too dirty, I tried to rouse myself by reliving in memory the golden moment on Katrina's porch when I first told her I loved her, and she first said it back. How I longed to hold her in my arms once more, to stroke her shining hair, to press my body against hers, to peel back the nap of her sweater, slide my hands beneath her clean, crisp t-shirt. Sighing, I heaved myself out of bed. Goddamn glass rod. Maybe I couldn't touch Katrina, but at least I could sneak in a phone call this morning. That was something worth getting out of bed for. I pulled on some sweatpants to the faint accompaniment of electronic blips and bleeps and joined Elder Deadman in the living room. "You're up early," I said, scratching my stomach and plopping down at the other end of the couch. He set aside his football game. "Just waiting for you to drag your lazy butt out of bed," he said, his eyes dancing like sugar plum fairies in an otherwise rumpled and sleepy face. "It's nearly 8. I think that's time to open presents." I had a large pile. From my parents and siblings came new ties and other little missionary accoutrements. My grandparents had sent a $15 check in a Christmas card, as they did every year, and Katrina sent me a paperback copy of 9 Stories by J.D. Salinger. I felt vaguely pleased with my gifts, but also disappointed, as if the Grinch had visited overnight to leech them of their capacity to bring joy. But if my Christmas morning felt anticlimactic as I drifted amongst a wreckage of wrapping paper and ribbon, Deadman's must have felt downright tragic. He only had 2 presents, one from his widowed mother and one from his aunt and uncle. If he felt badly about the disparity, though, he didn't show it. What he did do was reach down by the side of the couch and retrieve a big red envelope. "Merry Christmas, Elder," he said, handing it to me. The card inside was simple but beautiful, green, with the silhouette of a Christmas tree stamped in red foil. He must have picked it up while we were shopping for cards for our families. I opened it. Inside, he had written,
"Shun, thanks for being my companion. I hope this is your best Christmas ever. Drew Deadman. P.S. We are mighty Xmas tree hunters."
I stared at the words without blinking. "Thanks," I said, not looking at him. "Thanks a lot, Elder." He waited expectantly, but I didn't have a card or a gift to give him. It hadn't even crossed my mind. I sat there and felt like the world's biggest schmuck. After a few moments, Deadman stood up, dusting his hands on the back of his pants. "Well, hey," he said brightly, gathering up his presents and his torn wrapping paper. "I'll just get out of the way here so you can call your family and stuff. It's an hour earlier in Tacoma, so I don't mind waiting until you're done. Cradling his gifts to his chest, he went into the bedroom and pushed the door shut with his hip. I held my head in my hands for several minutes before picking up the phone, and then I only forced myself to do it by telling myself that I couldn't call Katrina until I'd talked to my family. Despite the rule against phoning home, most mission presidents allow their charges 2 calls per year, one on Mother's Day and another on Christmas. President Tuttle was no exception, and as I dialed my familiar home number, I was aware that as many as 30,000 other servants of God around the world were doing the very same thing that day, and that for most of them it was probably the highlight of the year. But I'd had one phone call with my parents already, and I wasn't much looking forward to another. My brothers and sisters were excited to talk to me. I spoke for a few minutes with each one in turn, and that lifted my spirits some. My mother told me about how she and my father had attended Marty Fowler's homecoming in Ogden, and how impressed they were with him as a person. My father told me that McCormick girl had dropped by earlier that week with a gift of Oreo cookies and burnt almond fudge ice cream. "How was she?" I asked, as hungry for eyewitness reports of her presence as a Vatican investigator for confirmation of a miracle. "I don't know," he said. "I turned the dogs loose on her." "Glad to hear you're still Mr. Hospitality. But the cookies were good." I let the matter drop, writing it off as the mordant joke it was. I didn't find it funny, but coming from my father it was familiar, and I found a strange sort of comfort even in that. There was no point turning it into an argument. After 45 minutes or so, I had spoken with everyone in the house. Feeling better than I had before, I said my goodbyes, reacquired the dial tone, and rang Katrina's number.
McCormick Residence.
Hi, Sister McCormick?
This is she.
It's Bill Shun calling.
Oh, hi! I thought that might be you. I had a suspicion we might be hearing from you. How's your Christmas?
Fine, just fine. A little quiet, I guess. How's yours?
Chaos. Thanks for asking. Listen, I know this is long distance, and I'm sure you didn't call to jabber with me all morning. I'll see if I can't round up Katrina for you.
Thanks. Merry Christmas, Sister McCormick.
Merry Christmas. Hold on a minute. Hello, Bill?
Katrina, hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
Just fine. Oh gosh, Bill, it's so wonderful to hear your voice again. I was so spoiled there for a while.
Yeah, I know. I missed hearing your voice, too.
I love you so much.
I love you, too.
Did you get the book I sent?
Yes, it's... Wow, I can't wait to read it.
That's one of my favorite books in the world. It's not science fiction, of course, but I think Michelle and I were 15 the summer we read it, and oh boy, let me tell you, all we wanted to do was hitch out east and knock on that man's door and throw ourselves at his feet.
Gosh, wow. Well, I can't wait.
You'll have to let me know what you think.
I will, I will. So, yeah, did you get the magazines I sent?
Yes. My gosh, where did you find those?
Just digging around in used bookstores.
They're wonderful. Thank you so much.
I thought you'd like them.
I do. And the picture you sent, that was just amazing. Bill loves Katrina forever. It was so wonderful.
I'm glad you liked it.
How long did that take you?
Elder Deadman and I spent one whole P-Day trying to take pictures of all the different letters. We went all over town, like trying to find a gate that looked like the letter E, or a hose we could arrange like an S, or whatever. Then when I got that roll developed, I still had to arrange all the photos on the floor and try to get the lamp positioned so the light was okay. I took a whole nother roll just hoping I'd get one that worked.
It worked. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
So how are you getting along with your new companion? You haven't said much about him in your letters.
He's hard to get to know.
You like him, though? You get along?
We get along.
Well, you keep working hard. You're my missionary.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. Oh, hey, I heard you finally took that ice cream over to my dad.
Your dad's such an old fart. I don't think it helped. He wouldn't even look me in the eyes.
He said he turned the dogs loose.
Yeah, he wishes. He wasn't very friendly, though. Colleen dropped by a couple of weeks before, and he wasn't much nicer to her.
I wish my dad was more like your mom.
Well, she's got issues of her own.
With me?
No, with me.
I don't have any issues with you. Besides the fact that you're so far away, I mean. Oh, man, I miss you, Katrina. I ache sometimes.
I miss you too, Bill. A lot. But you know what? I think I've finally gotten to the point where I've adjusted. You know, to the fact that you're going to be gone for another 20 months or so.
You have?
Well, yeah. I mean, what choice do I have? It's not like there's anything else I can do about it.
No, not really, I guess.
But just because I'm getting used to the idea doesn't mean if you turned up on my doorstep tomorrow, I wouldn't get over it in a heartbeat. I'd be thrilled.
Spots swam in front of my eyes, and my hands began to shake. In Mormon culture, the social cost of coming home early from a mission was high. If it weren't, there wouldn't have been 30,000 missionaries in the field. But now that cost was erased from my awareness, like snow wiped clean from a windshield, and I could see a road that wasn't visible before. I could leave my mission early, and Katrina would still love me. She had called, and I would come. Chapter 17. Just hop on the bus, Gus. It took me less than 5 minutes after distractedly hanging up the phone to work out the beginnings of a plan. I had several options. The most direct was just to throw my luggage in the car and drive, but that would effectively mean stealing a mission vehicle. I wasn't convinced the church would call the cops on me, but I couldn't afford to take chances. Besides, it didn't seem right to strand Elder Deadman in Brooks without a car. That just wouldn't be nice. The same compunction kept me from driving to Calgary to catch a plane. That and the fact that I didn't have the money for a ticket. I could have thumbed a ride south, but I'd heard enough horror stories from my father about what could happen to hitchhikers on lonely roads that no way in hell could you have gotten me into a stranger's car. No, my best option sounded like the bus. It was straightforward, it was cheap, and it lowered the risk of encountering a serial killer. While Deadman was still sulking in the bedroom, I looked up the Greyhound station in the phone book. Several buses a day rolled through Brooks on their way to Calgary, and from there it would be an easy transfer to a southbound coach. A 3 o'clock departure sounded best. 3 in the morning, that is. That would get me to Calgary around 6, with a 3-hour wait for the bus to Salt Lake City. That was 3 hours longer than I wanted to spend in Calgary, but if I could sneak out without waking Elder Deadman, then he probably wouldn't even be awake to report me missing until well after I'd made my connection. "Hey, Elder," I said, knocking on the bedroom door. "I'm all finished out here. The phone's yours." I only had one shot at this. I couldn't give anyone a chance to talk me out of it. I set my departure for early Monday morning. That gave me some much-needed time to prepare. But more importantly, I hoped the P-Day would make it harder for Elder Deadman to reach anyone at the mission office. It was a slim bet, but I'd take every advantage I could get. Until that weekend, I had perceived Elder Deadman as a fairly unintrusive companion, one who left me to my own devices and spent hour on end absorbed in his own time-wasting pursuits. Now, though, it seemed Deadman had attached himself to my elbow and would require surgical removal. I couldn't change my tie without him tagging along, nattering about the Edmonton Oilers or the skiing in Banff or the time he offered a hot babe a Book of Mormon and she gave him her phone number. I might have requested some privacy under any other circumstances, but now all I dared do was wait for him to leave me alone. On Christmas morning, while he was talking to his mother,
I had started stuffing clothes into my suitcases, but it didn't take me long to realize that I couldn't pack everything immediately, or the empty closet and drawers would give me away. So the rest of that long weekend, I spent anticipating Deadman's potty breaks, jamming socks and shirts into my suitcases like a demon valet the instant the bathroom door closed behind him. The few clothes I left in place as camouflage, not to mention my toiletries, and obvious personal effects like Katrina's picture, would have to wait until the moment of my escape. Sunday night, I sat up reading in the living room. Every piece was in place. I had returned all my library books. I had withdrawn all the oversized, colorful 20s I could from the Royal Bank ATM. And I had bid the Brooks ward a mental farewell that day at church. All I needed was for Deadman to go to bed, and he wasn't cooperating. From 9 until 10, the electronic bleats of Deadman's football game pierced my head like steadily worsening laser fire. But the death of the batteries at 10:15 offered only a temporary respite from the barrage. The fresh pair of double A's chilling in the egg rack promised gridiron mayhem through the wee hours of the morning. At 10:30, having read the same page of my book at least 7 times, I started to yawn, deliberately. Not much, just a languid jaw stretcher every couple of minutes. At 10:45, I amped up the frequency, and soon Elder Deadman was yawning too. I kept on turning pages, eyes fastened to the type, with no idea what I was reading. Several months later, at 11, Deadman put aside the game. He rubbed his eyes. "Think I'll hit the sack," he said. "Anything special you want to do for P-Day tomorrow?" "Eat supper on American soil," I thought. "Not really. Maybe a burger at that place downtown. You know, I should probably pack it in, too." While Deadman stretched his arms, I stood up and slipped past him into the bathroom. I took my time washing up, scanning the medicine cabinet to make sure my toiletries were all gathered together on one shelf. I left my contact lenses in my eyes. After relinquishing the bathroom to Deadman, I stripped off my sweatpants, tossed them in the closet, and pulled on a pair of jeans and a sweater as quickly as I could manage. By the time Deadman emerged, I was in bed with the covers pulled up to my chin, fully clothed.
"Companionship prayer, Elder?" said Deadman, his voice too loud in the claustrophobic darkness. His bedsprings squeaked. "Elder?"
I kept my face to the wall and played dead. I didn't sleep. Running the rest of the night's tasks through my mind, I kept watch on the clock. I tried not to think about my imminent reunion with Katrina, the taste of her sweet breath in my mouth, knowing a retreat into fantasy was the best way to drift off to sleep and miss my bus. The minutes dragged past like dying men in the desert, but I kept my eyes open. By midnight, Deadman seemed from his breathing to be secure in dreamland, but I gave it another half hour just to be safe. Another eternal half hour. At 12:30, I skinned back the covers and swung my legs cautiously to the floor. Over the course of the next several painstaking minutes, I ferried my two suitcases and my hanging suits and shirts into the living room. I swiftly packed the clothes, and I slipped Opus and the photograph of Katrina into my shoulder bag. Spying the loose-leaf notebook inside, I realized I hadn't updated my countdown calendar since Christmas Eve, when it stood at 615 days. It seemed I'd found a shortcut to zero. I put on my sneakers and zipped up my parka, and with my pulse hammering so loudly I could hardly hear, I carried everything up to the gravel drive outside. A sullen snow drifted down from the sky, sparse gray flakes falling like volcanic ash. I shoved my luggage into the back of the car, disconnected the extension cord from the grill, and climbed into the driver's seat. I heaved a short, nervous sigh. "This is it," I told myself. "Just drive to the station. Leave the bags, drive home, walk the mile and a half back, and wait for the bus to arrive. Then you're home free." I turned the key and pressed the accelerator. A shadow detached itself from the house and raced toward me in the rearview mirror. A solid thunk rattled the car. "What the hell?" I yelped, jamming my foot on the brake. Heart pounding, I put the car in park and jumped out. I should have kept going, as I realized about 2 seconds too late. Elder Deadman, spread-eagled where he had leaped onto the back of the car, hopped down and planted his hands on his hips. He was dressed in sweatpants, a pullover, and tennis shoes. I froze. "Where do you think you're going?" he said. "Shit." I shook my head, mouth full of gall. "Away." I started to get back in the car. Nimbly, he darted past me to block the driver's door. "You think I didn't know you were packing?" he said. "You think I'm stupid?" I tried to scrunch past him, but he pushed me back as easily as he would a little girl. "No," he said. "Tell me where you're going." "Home, okay? I'm sick of this shit." My hands balled into impotent fists. "Now let me go." "Yeah, right. And what am I going to tell Prez?" I clenched my teeth, so angry I thought I'd explode. "Tell him I sneaked out. Tell him I just disappeared. I don't give a shit what you tell him. Just let me leave." We stared at each other for about half a minute, the miserly snow falling around us like black thoughts, the idling car the only sound. "You should pray about this," Deadman said. "I have," I said, and it was true. I'd spent a lot of time praying the last few days. I wasn't really sure what answer I'd gotten, but I was trying hard to have faith that God approved. "Come to the church and pray with me, Elder. I'm not asking." Deadman climbed into the driver's seat. The keys were still in the ignition, of course. "Get in." Tears of frustration and rage stung my eyes. I looked at my watch. It was after 1, less than 2 hours to the bus. My gut knotted more tightly with every moment's delay. I sighed and went around to the passenger side. Ghosts thronged the pews of the chapel. They were ghosts of the living, ghosts of all the people I'd met in Brooks, the Van Rycks, the LeDucs, the Whitakers, the Alvarezes, all the people who thought, or once had, that I was a good missionary. As I picked my way up the aisle by the ghastly green light of the exit signs, they seemed to point their fingers at me. The lights snapped on and the ghosts fled. Deadman descended from the dais. "Right here, in front of the podium," he said, kneeling down between the dais and the first pew. "Come on." Reluctantly, I joined him. He closed his eyes, bowed his head, and offered a short but forceful prayer, asking Heavenly Father to pour out his spirit and give me the desire to stay on my mission. I didn't say amen when he finished. Deadman opened his eyes and shifted around to a sitting position. "Why did you come on a mission, Elder Shun?" he asked. His expressionless mask was in place. I stood up. "Flip. Because..." I gestured, groping for words. "Because that's what everyone wanted me to do." It was the first time I'd said it out loud, what I really felt. My throat tightened. "Yeah, me too," said Deadman, looking up at me. "But you've got to look beyond that. Why you came doesn't matter. What matters is that you're here. What matters is finding your own reasons to stay. Not anyone else's reasons. Your own." "Why do you stay?" I asked. "You don't do anything." He looked at his hands. "I'm not such a good missionary right now, I know. Maybe I just need some help. Just a push." I tried to push. "Maybe I need you to push harder." "Criminy," I said, walking away. Deadman jumped to his feet. "Shun, wait." I stopped, throwing my hands in the air. "Where can I go? You have the keys." "Elder Shun, what's the problem? What's so bad about this?" He regarded me with a look of incomprehension. "What can I do differently?" "You can't do anything. This isn't about you. I'm miserable. I hate being a missionary. I don't want to be here. I want to go to school and write my stories and sleep in my own bed and listen to music and see movies.
We can see movies if you want.
The offer was so absurd, I almost laughed. I gave a rueful snort instead. I don't want this, Elder. I want to go home.
You really want to go home?
I really want to go home.
You've thought this through?
Of course I have.
There's nothing I can do to talk you out of it.
Nope. He nodded his head, eyes downcast. He sighed.
All right, man.
He shook his head like he couldn't believe what he was saying.
How much time do you need me to buy you?
Deadman drove me to the station. I didn't say much. I felt if I opened my mouth I might babble in ecstatic idiocy, and I didn't want to rub his nose in it. It was his acquiescence that had made this possible. I tried to treat the gift with solemnity, not frivolity. When the headlights of the bus loomed out of the snow, Elder Deadman said,
"I'll wait until afternoon to call Prez. That should get you clear of Calgary and out of the mission."
"Thanks, man," I said, nodding. The bus pulled to a stop amid a welter of chuffs and squeals. Snowflakes swarmed like mosquitoes in the headlights. I bought a ticket for $18 from the driver, who stowed my luggage in the compartment beneath the coach. I shook hands with Elder Deadman, hardly believing I was going. "You take care, Elder," I said. He crushed me in a hit-and-run hug.
"Go with God," he said, stepping back, waving me onto the bus.
There were 10 or 12 people on board. I found a seat near the back, slid across cracked blue vinyl to the window. As the bus pulled away, Deadman stood there watching in the parking lot with his hands clasped behind his back, a derelict ghost in a storm of static. The gray noise swirled him to pieces, but I made out the look on his face before he vanished. Sad, desolate, yes, but envious, too.
Next time on The Accidental Terrorist.
In our next installment, Elder Shun braves the dark horrors of the Calgary Municipal Bus Depot. Will he pass undetected? Will he be nabbed by eagle-eyed missionaries lying in wait? If he makes it back to Utah, will Katrina really welcome him with open arms? What dread and bloody secrets of the Mormon temple lie carven deep in the tissues of his heart, turning the long road south into a demon-infested spiritual minefield? And what about Bob? The trouser-dampening terror is all here.
Just 1 week from now!
The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2006-2009 by William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.